Okay, so here we are in week two of session eight, and this session is our last session in this whole run through on time. We're going to switch over in session nine to space, and one of the reasons actually that I wanted to work with knowledge of time and space, or you know. Excuse me, back when I was getting When It Rains ready, one of the reasons it seemed like a good idea to work with knowledge of time and space is that it very systematically goes through the different levels or different dimensions of time, and that it does that with space. So that's true for all of the books in a way, but here it seems to me that it's really we can see the progression. And the reason I bring that up now is that we're getting into material now which is really about making this fundamental shift towards this new vision of knowledge. So if you say that level two, which we've been working with, is a kind of a transition, now we're going to start looking at things from a very different perspective. And that means that this material, what we're working with today and what we'll be working with over the next few weeks, that means that it's challenging. So we'll go through it, and I'll keep trying to reference that that point, you know, that it's not that it's hard. I mean, in a sense it is, but what's difficult, I mean, conceptually hard, what's difficult is to find ways to keep it from being just a theory, just an abstraction. And I'm going to keep trying to reference that, and you should let me know if you know, if you're having trouble at that level, or if you have questions, or for that matter, if you have suggestions and thoughts about how to proceed. Now, before we go into the chapter for today, let me point out something about the timings. Last week, I asked you to start thinking about the retreat, or a couple of weeks ago. And since then, I learned from Ratna Ling, because I had delayed in reserving the space, I learned from Ratna Ling that the space that I had originally planned at the time that I had originally planned for the retreat is already booked. So we have had to rebook. So we are currently booked for July 12th through the 17th for the retreat. And Kathleen will send out a reminder about that at some point, and I'll probably mention it in the next orientation also. But I wanted to announce it now. It's July 12th through the 17th. And that means that we have to change the timing of the final session, session 12, I guess it is, by a little bit. It means that we'll end on August 9th, which is a week later. We'll start a week later, and we'll end a week later. So July 12th through the 17th is the retreat. Okay. Now, let's look at this chapter, which I've already promised you is challenging. So we're talking about time's rhythm, and the chapter starts by talking about the motion of time's rhythm. Now, the very idea of that time's rhythm has its own motion is problematic in the sense that in order for there to be motion, as we ordinarily understand it, there has to be time, right? Something has to move in time or through time. But if we're talking about time's motion or movement, we can't say that it's moving through time. So clearly we're looking for a different dimension of time. And we're looking for a way in which time's motion is available, but it's not the usual kind of movement, it's not the usual kind of speed, which is another term that Rinpoche uses. in this chapter. It's not the usual kind of friction. All of these terms which Rinpoche uses, they can't have their ordinary meaning. We're activating a new vision here, and that vision is depends partly on using language differently, but of course it depends much more on experiencing or living differently. And it's problematic, and that's the sense in which I say that these chapters are difficult, or where we're headed now is difficult, because it's so clear that we can't use our ordinary understanding. So at the very bottom of page 83, which is the first page in this chapter, Rinpoche talks about the motion of time's rhythm, and he says it's inaccessible. Right? He says human experience cannot grasp it. Conceptual models cannot make sense of it. So that's the challenge. We're being told at the outset, no, you can't do this. It's not possible. So how can you do it anyway? And of course, the answer is implicit in the way it's phrased. If we go about experiencing in the way that we ordinarily experience, it won't work. And there's a steady pull to do that, to try to turn this new vision into a variation, maybe you could say, on the old vision. So we're being asked to make a very fundamental shift here. So I want to talk about that just a little bit, and then I will look at how Rinpoche invites us to do that, because he does give some pointers very, very clearly there. But first, what is this shift? Well, I'm going to describe it just in one set of terminology. You could describe it differently, but this comes out of the chapter. Ordinarily, we look at substance, right? Ordinarily, we look at substance, and in terms of time, we look at events. We look at things that have been identified and labeled and pronounced. There's all these different ways that Rinpoche talks about it. If you think back to a chapter from Dynamics of Time and Space that I'm pretty sure we read, Rinpoche says the world that we live in is always already grounded in the past. All these things that have been named. He says in Dynamics, everything has already happened. So that double sense of the past. What we would like to do, one of the things we've been exploring, is to be able to break free of that conditioned, pre-existing, presupposed reality. And we can do that in part, one of the ways we've explored, is by looking at the dynamic of time. Right? And so the way that we think about that, or one way to think about it, is as a process. Usually we see the product, we see the outcome. But if we can see a process emerging, see how reality is put together from moment to moment, we've talked that way in the past, if we can see all of that, then we can break through of our usual commitment and our usual commitments. But in this chapter, Rinpoche is pointing towards something a little more dramatic, you could say, because he says that we also need to give up process. Right? So on page 84, let's see here, he says there's a process, this is the first or second full paragraph on 84, he says there's a process that gives rise to a world and a temporal order. But then he says, seen from within the intrinsic unfolding, and that's a term that he talked about a little earlier, but this is time manifesting in a way that doesn't engage the usual structures. Seen from within the intrinsic unfolding, however, there is no process at all, only the intimacy of the of rhythm. So we're being asked even to go beyond process. That's really the point that I want to make here. So there's something pretty fundamental here. We're looking for a way in which we can engage the rhythm of time, or the motion of time's rhythm, as Rinpoche says. We can engage that in terms that go deeper than looking for a process, and even go deeper than our usual understanding of the dynamic of time. We're looking here for the intimacy of rhythm. So Rinpoche actually gives us a practice to do in this regard right at the beginning of the chapter, and I want to have us do that practice now. So this is one of these things he says where there's a tendency to kind of slide past it, you know, because he says, well, if we could do this, then that, and you kind of consider it for a moment and say, well, yeah, but I can't do that, or maybe eventually I'll figure out how to do that, or something like that. So if we can go through and find a way to do that, then it's, you know, then we have a new possibility. And Rinpoche gives us that possibility right in the first paragraph. He says, I'm skipping the first sentence, he says, the sense of time's rhythm is awake within us. The sense of time's rhythm is awake within us. So he's really saying right there that you know, time's rhythm seems very abstract, it has nothing to do with process, but we actually have immediate access to it. It's awake within us. And he says, if we stay with this sense, not applying models or engaging the ordinary appearance of objects, we notice within time's rhythm a specific embodying, a movement without movement, somewhat like floating. So I think it's valuable to take that as a practice instruction. In the unfolding of experience within the rhythm of time, before or independent of models or what ordinarily appears, although things do appear, we do apply models, but within that, we notice within time's rhythm a specific embodying, a movement without movement, somewhat like floating. So the best clue we have here, I suppose, as to how one might do this is when he says it's somewhat like floating. So if you think about floating in water, there is the whole idea, you could say, of floating is that you're not going anywhere. You're just floating. I'm thinking about a human being floating. Other things float too, but the way we float. So you're not going anywhere, and yet there's a steady movement, right? And it's a different kind of embodying. I don't know if this is accurate, but you might think for a moment about what it's like to be driving in a car or sitting in a car while someone else is driving. And on the one hand, you're absolutely still, at least in principle. And on the other hand, you're moving through the countryside. You're moving down the road. So there's a kind of a stillness. I'm not sure that particular metaphor works because we are looking for a rhythm. But maybe if we looked at the rhythm of our bodies in the midst of the stillness, even as we were moving. But let's stay with the image of floating. You know, there is a specific kind of embodying, a movement without movement. So we may not know how to do that, but I think we should give it a try now. So for five minutes, let's look at that, right? Within time's rhythm, there's a specific embodying, a movement without movement. And that is time's rhythm awake within us. So let's practice with that for 5 minutes, okay? Okay. So let's come together. I'm curious to hear what...
Feels like a supportive buoyancy.
Supportive buoyancy. Yeah, that's very interesting. I had a similar experience. So, of course, obviously you're right. I was struck that that's implied in the image of floating, right? The water points us, lifts us up, and time in some sense seems to do that too. Anybody else want to comment on that? I'll say something related to that, which is, once that idea, that sense kind of came to me, I started thinking about being in a crowd that's, a sports event, or right now we have this event going on, so I hear a crowd off in the distance, and the kind of excitement of a crowd has that same supporting quality, it seems to me. Okay. So, David writes, no business of minding, free-forming, non-controlling, allowing whatever arises. In that non-specific awareness, there is a fullness, an expanded focus, breath, heartbeats, colors, visual movement, sounds, a full sensual aliveness, a continuum. Okay. Yeah. Again, the word continuum seems to me to go in the same direction. And then you could say, well, what shows up? The kinds of things that you mentioned, David. Those are all supported. So it's interesting because we usually think of space as when we talk within the TSK vision, we talk about space as allowing everything, but perhaps it makes sense then to say that time supports everything. Interesting. Okay. Let's see. Sudhi says that buoyancy does not have a rhythmic sense to it. It's continuous. So why use the word rhythm? Maybe I don't know the meaning of rhythm. Well, no, you're raising a great question. I think it would be a question. It is a question to explore. If you say, well, buoyancy, where do you find the rhythm in that? Well, maybe the sense of rhythm that is being pointed to here is not exactly like the rhythm that we normally think of in music. What is it like? I don't have a good description for it. But I was actually trying to practice with this exercise or anticipating this exercise yesterday while I was listening to some music. And I didn't come to any conclusions, but it did strike me that the rhythm of music is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about something more fundamental. Okay, Ken says, there's a sense of non-directional movingness. Self arises, falls away within a billowing field. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Maybe the billowing has something to do with the rhythm, right? It seems to have to do with the buoyancy. So we have all these words where We're kind of wrestling with this idea of what is this rhythm and what is the motion of the rhythm. So if we talk about buoyancy as a kind of motion and billowing, some of you who are not native speakers, to billow is to kind of expand out in a breeze, kind of roughly like that. These kind of grand movements that don't go anywhere, that's part of it, but that are movement nonetheless. Okay. John says, whatever we do or however we focus our awareness, in that doing or awareness, we are literally expressing time's rhythm. Whether it's stillness or activity, it can take on any modality. This underlying energy then is very supportive, very with me. Yeah. You know, there has to be some sense if what Rinpoche is presenting here is touching on something that's helpful. There has to be some sense of that we are always, that our activity is always an expression of time's rhythm. And there is a very simple sense in which you might say, in which that has to be true. Because for anything to happen at all, time has to support it. Let's use that word. I was going to say time has to allow it, but let's give space allowing right now and give time supporting. I'm not sure we would have to stick with that, but you can't lift your finger without time. You can't come into being, certainly, without time. So in some sense, time is a support for the arising of everything. And if we think of it now as this, as the rhythm, if the rhythm leads us back into that fundamental supporting quality that, as you say, John, can take on any modality, then maybe we're in touch with something that helps us make sense of our own being in a new way. So Michael writes, when a rhythm embraces our whole environment with us in it, we tend not to notice. Right. Very, the coursing of Earth around the sun, the rotation of the Earth under our feet, the rising and falling of the ocean in which we float deep at sea. The rhythm is all the more dynamic when it is beyond our capacity to notice it. And that's a very nice point. Perhaps such rhythms are a place to look for the deep truths about our lives. Yeah. So, the deeper or the deeper the rhythm or the more encompassing the rhythm is what you're saying, you know, maybe the more dynamic it is, which of course is the opposite of what we usually think. Rinpoche gives the example in this chapter of the earth moving through space. He says, the rhythm of time, I think I have this right, the rhythm of time is, it's not something we can notice. And just like the movement of the earth through space, the difference is that, it seems to me, that the movement of the earth through space is, you know, we're just never going to be able to notice the movement of the earth through space. Now, I could be wrong about that, I guess. But that's something that's theoretical for us. Whereas the billowing, floating, supporting rhythm of time, we can tune into. That's the suggestion that's made here. Okay. Well, that's very nice. I think those are really good suggestions, and they lead us in a really good way. And I like this idea of looking for time, looking for the rhythms of time in the kinds of deeper movements that we don't even know how to contact. That makes sense to me. Okay. Well, let's go on and look at some of the rest of the chapter now. Let's see. So, okay, this rhythm, this motion, the motion of time's rhythm that's awake within us. You know, Rinpoche goes on to say it's slower than what we can observe in terms of the logos, and it's much faster than what we can experience in terms of substance. There's a kind of a paradox there, which I won't try to go into. But what we can say is, and this is still just going back to the first sentence of the chapter, the motion of that rhythm, it's not tied to things, it's not tied to structures, for reasons I think we've already gotten into. And at the same time, it's not abstract. And I said at the beginning that that's what we really want to watch out for, is we don't want to turn this into some sort of theory about the way time is. It's when that rhythm is alive within us, and whether it's as a billowing or a floating or something more rhythmic than that, that we haven't found yet, or a fullness or a wholeness. That's what we want to be able to do. I noticed there's a couple of more comments, so let me come back. So I've heard the metaphor of the bird kestrel. The kestrel is a kind of bird, a hawk, I think. Opening its wings against the wind, for describing the stillness of the awareness that notices the movement in one's experience. That reminds me, I'm not sure I'm really responding to what you say, sometimes I'm up at our country center, Odeon, and there are times on a still day when a bird flies by, say a raven, and you hear the flapping of its wings, and because it's so quiet, there's nothing else happening. And somehow that movement seems to point towards a stillness. You know, it kind of calls out the underlying stillness of everything else. Maybe that's related to what you're saying. It's a kind of, yeah, exactly. Okay. And Ken says it helps to move toward sort of an activated wholeness by doing mind, body, emotion, interaction. So that's pretty much exercise 7 in TSK, for those of you who keep score. By doing mind, body, emotion, interaction, to live in and from the sea, which Michael points to. Yeah. Now, that's exactly what we're looking for, is to live in and from the sea. And that doesn't mean that the chips don't pass by. You know, it doesn't mean that things don't happen. But that's always with us. You know, I've read things where people say, well, the sea is a part of us because it, you know, salt water courses through our veins, I mean, in our blood. Maybe that's helpful to think of that. Okay. I was starting to point out that we're not talking about an abstraction. We looked at an experiential way of getting into this. Notice that I'm using the word experience here, but we've discussed many times in the past that experience is usually related, the idea of experience is related to the one who experiences, and it's very caught up in our ordinary understanding. And that's not quite right, but maybe there's a different way of experience. So, how could we get into this? Well, one way would be, and I think this is what the chapter does now, is to understand, if you presuppose a kind of an aliveness, a dynamic, a motion of time's rhythm, the kinds of things that Rinpoche is pointing towards here, if you presuppose those, or if you say that possibility is there, then you could analyze how it's lost. And, of course, there's many, many places in the TSK books where Rinpoche talks about how things get frozen into place. And it's always a little different because it's always in a different context. But here, he's talking about the speed of time's dynamic, and what I mean by here, at page 84, and he makes a very fundamental point, which will be important as we go on to the next chapter. So down at the bottom of page 84, maybe it's actually a little higher up. The basic idea, the point that he's making here, is that the rhythm turns into points. You have speed, and I'm looking for the place, the very specific place in here where he talks. Oh, here, at the very top of page 84. He says, from another point of view, this speed, so the speed of the motion of time's rhythm, is transformed as it enters the realm of the outsider. It becomes points. So you could say, you know, once you have a temporal order in which there is the bystander and the outsider, we've looked at that before, then in the realm of the outsider, nothing gets moved, or nothing moves exactly, but what happens is that speed is transformed into matter or into points. That's the analysis or discussion that he's making here. And we've talked about that before, that energy becomes matter, or really for our purposes, that time becomes the substance of the temporal order, or the substance that the Logos recognizes. That's what he's talking about here, right? To go back to that passage. The speed becomes points and begins to build up a continuum. Rhythm builds from point to point of space and segment to segment of time. The waves of rhythm lead to origins. Origins give boundaries, and boundaries call forth continuity to link together what is bound. So time becomes the temporal order. You know, we've talked before about the relationship between the Logos and the temporal order. I think Logos is, as we've been reading through these passages, I've gotten more clear about this. I think Logos is the kind of fundamental understanding that gives us an order. Temporal order, and the temporal order is what emerges. You know, a reality emerges. So time is always available. Time is always this kind of support that people were talking about in responding or commenting on the exercise we did, and it becomes. It becomes a temporal order. From the point of view of time, it doesn't become anything. You know, as Rinpoche says here, there's no process, there's no unfolding. There's just the intimacy of rhythm. But we lose that. That gets totally overlooked in terms of the commitment to substance. And so you have something coming into being, and yet it never really has come into being. It remains this substance. So there's this line, one of these lines, and it sticks out for me in the TSK books. What is emerges as the echo of itself. Nothing is ever really established. Nonetheless, a measured-out realm takes form. And the point that Rinpoche starts to make here, and this is important as we go on in the reading, is that we tend to think of points as being fundamental. So, you know, if you think in terms of matter, certainly, of a material world, you say, well, there have to be little atoms or something like that. Now, of course, physics will tell us that atoms are not really point-like, and in fact, they you know, their existence is only as a matter of probability. That's the best way physics has of making sense out of that. Or you could also think of the fact that, you know, points or atoms or particles, under some circumstances, show up more as waves. This is, you know, I'm just kind of gesturing towards particle physics. I don't think it's too helpful to try to go into great detail, but as an analogy, it's pretty interesting. So whatever emerges really doesn't have any substance, and the tendency to take points seriously, you could say, is misguided. And at the bottom of 84, Rinpoche says, points themselves are based on motion, understood in terms of continuity. The demand for continuity means that motion requires a mover, and origin requires a creator. But what he's suggesting, and this is a kind of a conceptual structure, you could say, to help support our inquiry into the possibility of an immediate encounter with the dynamic of time, with the motion of time's rhythm. The conceptual structure that he's suggesting to do that, top of page 85, he says, internally, rhythm comes before the logos. It whirls the points of measured time and space into being. It establishes the logos and its order. Points express the rhythm through which they arise and which sustain them. So what's fundamental here is that the Rinpoche is saying we're completely focused on one way of understanding, which has to do with points that are established and create a continuity and create a temporal order. But underneath that, more fundamental than that, is the temporal rhythm. And so that's just a helpful way of thinking about how we could make room in our vision, you know, make room in our way of making sense of the world for something that doesn't depend on points, that doesn't depend on a temporal order, but is more related to rhythmic time. And then you have this point, which we looked at earlier, I think, about even process doesn't really originate. What happens in this way, in this rhythmic movement of time, is that the process itself is also part of that structure. Right? It says on page 84, the process is absorbed into its product. So it's not enough to look to process if you want to go to this level, although it can be helpful. So suppose we wanted to stay true to that, or stay true to the sense of whatever exists arising as its own echo. We would have to, it seems to me, be able to let go of our positioning, be able to let go of our identifying. And several of the comments that you've made seem to me to go into that direction. Right? Whatever we do, I am quoting here from John, whatever we do, however we focus our awareness, we're expressing time's rhythm. It can take on any modality. So you give up your commitment to the particular modality or to the particular expression. And again, David mentioned some other examples. You know, there's this fullness, and within that you find all sorts of things. You know, you find breath, heartbeats, color, visual movement, sounds, a full sensual aliveness. And David, you tend mostly to go to the senses, and here that makes perfectly good sense to me, because the senses have this fullness to them. You know, when we get to the realm of thought, well, now we're kind of, it's like what Plato says about the poets, you know, they're making an imitation of an imitation or an echo of an echo. That's kind of what thoughts are like. So if we can stay more with the immediacy of experience, then rhythm, even if we don't quite understand yet what rhythm is, you know, then that underlying rhythm may be more available to us. So the world is an echo of itself. It's kind of ghostly, but it's also, that doesn't mean that it's not real. One way of thinking about that, and we've talked about this a couple of times in the past, is what we mean by the sense of the symbolic, by using symbols. I tried looking around a little for a nice phrase or two that would capture that. What I found was something in Sacred Dimensions on page 36, where Rinpoche is talking about space, not time. But he says, perhaps space has its own way of appearing, a way that is closer to symbol than substance. And you know, one of the things that is said in different ways again and again in the DSK books is that space disappears and time is frozen and knowledge is, you know, converted into, what could we say, information. We've lost touch with the fundamental facets of our being. If you think about the symbolic as a way in which space and time and maybe even knowledge can appear, that gives you the possibility of a way in. And I was thinking about this in terms of the image we used last week about projection. Remember, we talked about projection and creation. And then I said, well, it's kind of like a movie projector, right? The image on the screen is one dimension, but there's also the light that projects the image. The reason I bring it up again now is because it struck me that you know, you might say, well, it's very boring. It's very boring to focus on the light rather than the images that are projected, because the light always stays the same. You know, the images, that's where the story is. That's where the entertainment value is if you're thinking about movies. But I'm not so sure of that, because if you're aware of the content of a movie, and you don't get sucked into it completely, but are aware of it as a projection, that is, as a movie, then you open yourself up to the aesthetic dimension of the movie in a way that you might not otherwise. You know, some movies just try to manipulate you. You know, they manipulate your emotions. I personally think horror movies are like that, although I haven't seen one in a long time, and I may be wrong. But other movies really, in a sense, call attention to themselves as projections. And that dimension of what's going on in the movie is actually a very rich element of what the movie is all about. And you might say that kind of goes back to the idea of the world itself, the world we live in, as a symbol. It's when you see it as a symbol that time becomes available. Okay, well, let me go to one more point before we stop, because we're just about out of time. I just wanted to see, okay. I'm just checking to see if there are any more comments. There aren't. So I wanted to talk for just a few minutes about friction. Because I think this is another way in which the reading, in which the text here is suggesting that we could make contact with the rhythm of time. He gives a very interesting definition of friction on page 86 when he says, as motion unfolds, points come into contact, almost superimposed. So we're already in a realm in which points have been established. You know, to use the image in the book, time's rhythm whirls points into existence, and now they've been established. And when they come into contact, that generates friction, understood as the carrier of momentum. The definition he gives is, friction is the response to the logical necessity for momentum to continue endlessly. Friction also expresses the demand that existence be uninterrupted. That has to do with the fundamental drive to exist the assumptions we make about the continuity of the self over time, and meaningful patterns such as birth, decay, and dissolution. Well, all of those examples, all of those specifications of what friction is all about have to do with the way in which the rhythm of time is co-opted, is taken over by the demand to exist, right? It's when we make demands, when we take positions, when we insist on things being a certain way or identify substance, the reality of substance, then time's rhythm turns into friction. And you know, in most circumstances, we could say friction is unpleasant. There's the sort of natural movement is being undermined or held back or you come into conflict. So when there is friction, that's a pointer toward the rhythm of time having been appropriated in the wrong way. So I think that it makes sense now to look at friction as an opportunity to understand the rhythm of time, because it's what happens when that rhythm is not allowed to unfold on its own. If you look at the last sentence of the chapter, he says, traced to its origin, in accord with a knowing more fully in tune with time's momentum, which is what we would like to develop, the logos proves to be the external manifestation of the inner dynamic of rhythm brought into being by the mechanism of friction. So that kind of tracing, that kind of awareness of friction as it operates can lead back into an awareness of the rhythmic momentum of time. All we need to do is shift our knowing more in that direction. It looked like, okay, there were a couple of more comments, so let me just try to look at those quickly. That was the point I wanted to make about friction, and I'm going to suggest in the orientation that's the walk around. You know, if you think of friction in a broad sense, whenever something goes wrong, whenever a demand isn't met, whenever something feels uncomfortable or unhappy, you could see that as friction in operation. And there, that would be an opportunity then to look to see, is there an underlying temporal rhythm takes you deeper than that surface friction. Okay, I just wanted to take a look at a couple of comments. Oops, I lost it again, sorry. Okay, so Sudhi says, so it seems that the energy of time's rhythm is similar or the same as the primordial awareness. Let me just say, you know, this last sentence we read, I think can help show how those things come together, because he's talking about a knowing that's more fully in tune with time's momentum. If you want to think of that as primordial awareness, maybe that's good. And Michael says, going back to his image of the sea and time as a support, the surrounding support of the sea is kinder to our inflated rafts than the sharp points of the logos. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. When we live in a pointy world, things are always in danger of popping, right? Or hurting. We're talking about a sea, a kind of support which is much more supportive and healing. The urge to specify works better as an expression of a greater fullness than as an attempt to establish a final truth. In the latter case, we are bound to get that deflated think you mean deflated feeling. The urge to specify. Yeah. So that's okay. We're out of time, so I'm not going to try to comment on it. But the distinction you make there, I think, is helpful. And Hayward says, psychologically speaking, friction can signal that a position has been taken. I'd say yes, that's exactly right. That's one way of talking about this distinction. So during this coming week, explore friction. You know, we do know, we do have access to friction, and see how that could lead you back into the rhythm of time. Okay, we will stop there. Thank you very much.